Sweet in the morning. Oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning.
Hello, this is Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White, and the name of this program is Wake Up Call. And I'd like to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call.
Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning. Sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning. Ooh, oh, 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 sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning. Ooh, oh, oh, sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning. Ooh, oh, oh, sweet in the morning. Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning. Sweet in the morning, ooh, 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 ooh. Sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning, ooh, 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 ooh. Sweet in the morning, sweet in the morning, sweet, sweet in the morning.
Today on Wake Up Call, we have a lot of ground to cover. We're going to talk about some of the things that are happening nationally, as well as some of the things that are happening internationally, and take a look at a phenomenon that plagues this country and has an effect on black people throughout the diaspora. And that issue is reparations. All of that coming up here on Community Public Radio. My name is Bernard White. Once again, we continue.
Media in Zimbabwe has released photos of President Robert Mugabe meeting with military leaders following an army takeover of the country. The 93-year-old president is under house arrest after the military seized control of state media and blocked key access to government buildings. Here's what Major General Sibusiso Moyo had to say to the international community in an address televised by the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation.
To both our people and the world beyond our borders, we wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover of government. What the Zimbabwe Defense Forces is doing is to pacify a degenerating political, social, and economic situation in our country, which, if not addressed, may result in a violent conflict.
However, many say a suspect a coup is still underway as developments come following Mugabe's dismissal of Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa last week, a move which placed his wife, Grace Mugabe, in the position of successor. Mnangagwa has close ties to the military, having served as the nation's defense minister. For some analysis, I want to turn now to Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire. Abayomi, do you believe a coup has indeed taken place in Zimbabwe? Zimbabwe, or are we simply witnessing shifts within the ruling ZANU-PF party?
The military has been very keen not to describe what is happening as a coup d'etat because it is being rejected throughout not only the Southern African Development Community, but the African Union president today, Alpha Conde from Guinea-Conakry, also enunciated that they would not accept a rule by a military junta in Zimbabwe. Now, earlier today, there were negotiations that took place between the president as well as the Minister of Defense, Mr. Sekeremaia, and also the involvement of the Southern African Development Community, where the Minister of Defense from the Republic of South Africa, Nosiswe Mapisa Nkula, participated in these discussions. They did not take place in Mugabe's residence. They took place in the president's office at State House. So apparently there is a multilateral effort to bring about some resolution to this political conflict that's taking place in Zimbabwe.
Interests within the ruling party, as well as foreign interests in Zimbabwe, who would benefit from perhaps the, some are saying, the dismissed Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa taking power? What might his agenda be?
Well, you have two political factions within the ruling Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party. One faction was surrounding the First Lady, Grace Mugabe, who in fact has been a controversial figure inside of Zimbabwe. Also, we have a situation where the ousted Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa was also has very ties, close ties with the government, the military forces within the government. And of course, on Monday, the head of the Zimbabwe Defense Forces, Constantine Chiwenga, delivered a press conference at the military headquarters, stating that if the purges did not stop, that the military would intervene. We saw on Tuesday tanks in the streets of Harare. And of course, at 4 a.m. on Wednesday morning, the Major General S.B. Moyo went on Zimbabwe television to announce that they had the president at his residence. He was not being harmed. He was safe and sound. And that they wanted to target what they described as criminals surrounding the president.
What would the significance of Mugabe's potential removal or resignation be? What is his legacy when it comes to Zimbabwe's history?
Well, his contributions are immense. During the 1960s, he was arrested by the former settler colonial regime of Ian Smith. He spent 10 years in prison. He was released in 1974. He went to Tanzania and then later Mozambique to lead and guide the national liberation struggle. In 1979, he and the late Joshua Nkomo, who headed another liberation movement, ZAPU, Zimbabwe African People's Union, they negotiated a transition to an independent Zimbabwe, which was realized in April of 1980. Mugabe has been in power now for some 37 years. And even though he's 93 years old, he still commands the respect of the people in Africa, as well as elements within an international community. He delivered an address just 2 months ago at the United Nations 72nd General Assembly that caught the attention of people around the world. So I think his status on the African continent is sound. And this is why the Southern African Development Community, as well as the AU, is very careful about not inflaming the existing tensions that exist in Zimbabwe, and at the same time trying to ensure that the president is not harmed in any way.
Finally, in the mainstream Western press, we often only hear about Zimbabwe when it's being discussed for record inflation or allegations of corruption. Indeed, even now, many headlines read along the lines of how Mugabe crashed the economy. One at the BBC even states, "Zimbabwe crisis, thanks for taking out the tyrant." What is your response to these criticisms?
Well, you cannot analyze the current economic situation in Zimbabwe without addressing the draconian, systematic sanctions that have been imposed on the country at least since 1998. They were intensified in 2000. And of course, this is the real reason behind the economic crisis in Zimbabwe and throughout the entire region of Southern Africa.
All right, Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire, we really appreciate your analysis this afternoon.
Thank you.
African violet, ain't you through dreaming yet? With all your roots so deep, how come you're still asleep? Afro-American, I tell you like a friend. Try to remember, dear, we're only strangers here. My heart is in Zimbabwe because my friends are there. African violet, sometimes your eyes are wet. So many dreams you keep, oh, so many tears you weep. Afro-American, I tell you once again, try to remember, my dear, we're only pilgrims here. Some people come explore one day, they see beautiful children. running through the sunshine, yeah. They say we take these people, peaceful, peaceful people, to another climbing place. Make them work from day to day, heaping dirt up on their face. Children, yeah, yeah, yeah. Children, yeah, yeah, yeah. Bring them in chains. Take away their names. Heap on them disgrace. Then remove them from this place. Multiply their fears for 450 years. Then tell them they are free, but remove the means for them to be African violent. African violent, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Accusers, and does he think Roy Moore should drop out of this race?
Look, the president believes that these allegations are very troubling and should be taken seriously, and he thinks that the people of Alabama should make the decision on who their next senator should be.
So that's a no, he thinks Roy Moore should stay in?
Look, the president said in his statement earlier this week that if the allegations are true, then that Roy Moore should step aside. He still firmly believes that.
Maybe. How would the president like to see that truth proven?
Look, I'm not going to get into and litigate back and forth, but the president's been clear that if any of these allegations are true, allegations that he takes very seriously, finds very troubling, if those do happen to be true, then he should do the right thing and step aside.
Does the president believe the accusations themselves, that is to say the women themselves and their own credibility, can be established outside of them making these allegations? What's the mechanism by which the president would be satisfied that the allegations are true?
Look, I don't think the president's laid out what the mechanisms are. That should be determined possibly by a court of law. But that's also something in a decision that the people of Alabama need to make, not the president, whether or not they want Roy Moore to support them in the Senate.
Yeah. Sarah, Ivanka Trump says that she has no reason not to believe the women who come forward. Does the president disagree with her position?
Look, the president's not disagreeing with anybody. He's saying that he finds the allegations to be extremely troubling. He doesn't know any more than you do on this fact, other than that these are something that should be taken very seriously and that the people of Alabama should be the ones to make the decision on whether or not to support Roy Moore.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah. Having the information that we have and the information that the people of Alabama have, would President Trump vote for Roy Moore?
The president's not a voter in Alabama, so
I know he's not, but he endorses candidates all the times in states that he's not a voter in, and he says, I would vote for this person or I wouldn't. Would he vote for Roy Moore?
I haven't asked him if he would vote for Roy Moore.
Would you get back to us on that?
John?
Thank you, Sarah. A number of Republican senators have pulled their endorsement for Roy Moore. They've urged him to step aside. Senator Shelby said he wouldn't even vote for him. He'd write some in, one in on the ballot. Senator Cruz has pulled his endorsement. The president is not only president of the United States, commander-in-chief, he's also leader of the Republican Party. Why won't he weigh in on this? Why won't he take the same type of strong position that these other Republican senators have taken on Roy Moore?
Look, the president supported the decision by the RNC to withdraw resources from this race, but feels it's up to the people of Alabama to make the decision. I don't have anything further to add on that front.
Sarah.
James.
Thank you, Sarah. I don't mean by asking about this to suggest it's necessarily the most important thing facing the country right now, but it happens to be my story assignment for the day. You say that the president finds these allegations against Mr. Moore, Judge Moore, to be very troubling, extremely troubling, etc. As we all know, the president faced a number of similar allegations or somewhat similar allegations during the course of the campaign, and he vigorously denied them. But I wonder what you would assert to be the difference between the two situations, such that on the face of things, we should find one set of allegations very troubling, and on the other, we shouldn't pay attention to them at all, or we should totally disbelieve them.
Well, I think the president has certainly a lot more insight into what he personally did or didn't do, and he spoke out about that directly during the campaign, and I don't have anything further to add beyond that. Jim?
On Roy Moore, with the president campaign with Roy Moore?
Not that I'm aware of.
And can I ask you a follow-up? Do you think he's a creep?
Do I?
Yeah.
Look, I don't know Roy Moore. I haven't met him in person, so I wouldn't be able to respond to that. Kristen?
Does the president think that Roy Moore is qualified to serve in the U.S. Senate?
Look, the president, as I've said about seven or eight times now, thinks that this is a decision for the people of Alabama
Sarah,
to make.
Sarah, we've heard from you. We've heard from Ivanka on this. When are we going to hear from the president himself?
The president has put a statement out earlier in the week when we were on the trip, and he stands by that statement.
He's ignored shouted questions for two straight days. He's the president of the United States, the leader of the Republican Party. I think a lot of people want to hear
him. I'm aware of all of those qualifications of the president, and it's actually my job to come out here and answer questions on his behalf, which I'm doing, which I've done, and which he has done repeatedly over the last 12 days while we were on a trip across Asia. So to act like he hasn't answered questions is just silly.
Does he think Senator Al Franken should step down?
What does
he
think of Senator Al Franken?
Sorry, Kristen, I'm going to move around.
On the other side of the aisle, does the president have a response to the allegations against Senator Al Franken and also the mistrial over Senator
Bond? On Senator Franken, it appears that the Senate is looking into that, which they should, and we feel that's an appropriate action. I haven't asked him about Senator Menendez.
Thank you, Sarah. Before the president left for his trip to Asia, he called on the Justice Department to look into the Democrats and that situation, as he put it. And then days later, the Attorney General asked special prosecutors to look into the Uranium One allegations in the Clinton Foundation. Did the president cross any lines or try to influence the Justice Department and the Attorney General to look into the situation of the Democrats?
Look, the president hasn't directed any investigation or the appointment of a special counsel. In fact, he said publicly that he hasn't been involved with that, and that's entirely up to the Department of Justice. Brian.
Thank you very much. Going back to Russia just a bit, when he said that he spoke with Putin and he believed that Putin meant what he said, in other words, there was no collusion with the government.
He actually said he believed that Putin believed what he said, okay, and that he wasn't going to get into an argument with him over that when they had bigger things like North Korea, like the issues in Syria that they needed to deal with and work together on.
Okay, so the question being, he's always maintained that it was the Democrats who colluded with Russia. Is he saying that Putin exonerated the Democrats?
Look, the president still firmly believes that there was collusion with the Democrats during this election process. But, again, he's not going to get into the back and forth with a world leader that he needs to work with and wants to work with in order to deal with some of the big and serious things that are facing our country right now.
Thank you.
Sorry, Brian, I'm going to move ahead. Francesca.
Thank you, Sarah. China has announced that it's sending a special envoy to North Korea tomorrow. The president was just in Beijing. Is that something that the president talked to President Xi about while he was there? Is that something that the president favors?
The president certainly favors China taking a greater role in putting maximum pressure on North Korea. This is one of the things that he and President Xi spoke extensively about over the course of our visit. And certainly any effort in order to denuclearize the peninsula there in North Korea, then China participating in that, the president certainly supports those efforts.
That's right. And I have another question about China and trade. Yesterday in his remarks, the president said that we can no longer tolerate unfair trading practices that steal American jobs, wealth, and intellectual property. The days of the United States being taken advantage of are over. He specifically mentioned China as he said all of those words. Does the president still believe that China is raping the U.S. economy?
Look, the president knows that there hasn't been a fair and reciprocal trade with China. He doesn't think that we've had great deals in place with China, and he's been very clear, and he was very clear directly with President Xi, which he'll continue to be, that we want to make sure that Americans and American workers in particular are getting the best deal and the best pieces possible. That was one of the reasons that he worked to secure massive deals of totaling over $250 billion while he was in China. He's going to continue to push for those types of efforts. Jeff?
Sure. I'd like to ask you about two other topics. The tax bill was passed by the House today. One of the things that the tax bill does is increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion. I know the White House has argued that that will be paid by growing the economy. But if the economy doesn't grow, how do you square that with the Republican view or general principle that the deficits are bad? And on a second,
I mean, I just disagree with the premise of the question. We do expect the economy to grow. We've seen that happen over the last 10 months, and we expect that to continue.
But are you confident that the economy will grow consistently enough to cover these costs that otherwise would lead to a ballooning deficit?
Yes, that's been part of our process and part of what we've laid out from the beginning. We expect this to be consistent, and that's certainly what we hope for. That's one of the reasons that the president continues to push for things like deregulation that have helped boost the economy. He's going to continue to push things that help do that and accomplish that, and we feel confident moving forward.
Yeah.
Take one last question. Amen.
Thanks, Sarah. So Senator Johnson, Republican, has raised some questions about the fairness of the tax proposal, particularly the disparity between corporate and individuals and the way they're big corporations and regional corporations and the way they're treated as well. So the question is, what concessions is the White House prepared to make to Senator Johnson? And if you do make concessions to him, are you worried that other Republicans will demand their own concessions on issues of importance to them and you'll have just a revolving door of senators who want something from you in this bill?
I think that's something for the members of the Senate to work through. Certainly not something the president is getting into the necessarily the back and forth of that conversation at this point in time. Again, he spoke with Senator Johnson. He supports the priorities. He wants to work with members of the Senate to bring them together to make sure that we pass historic tax cuts and tax reform.
Did you offer Senator Johnson anything when they spoke?
No, but he did encourage him to get on board and support the tax reform package. Thanks so much, guys. We'll be around the rest of the afternoon.
Democratic Senator Al Franken has been accused of sexual assault by a reporter, a radio reporter by the name of Leanne Tweeden. Just full disclosure, Leanne Tweeden is someone who was on the show that I used to host for the network, The Point. She came on a regular basis, and I know her personally. But I didn't know this story until now, because today was the first time that she spoke about her experience with Al Franken back in 2007. Now, she shared her account in a published article for ABC, and she accused him of kissing and groping her without consent during a 2006 USO tour of the Middle East before he took public office. So I apologize, it was 2006, not 2007. She wrote that it occurred in December of 2006, not long before Christmas, when she was a performer for the tour alongside Mr. Franken, then a well-known comedian. Now, there were two components of her accusations that really stood out to me and to most people. The first accusation is what he did to her, allegedly did to her physically. According to Ms. Tweeden's account, Mr. Franken wrote a body script that included a kiss for the two to perform on stage. When it came time to rehearse the skit, she wrote, Mr. Franken insisted on kissing despite her protestations. So she didn't want to kiss, and then he went for it, and she claims that he grabbed her in the back of the neck and tried to make it happen, but she pushed him off. She says, I immediately pushed him away with both my hands against his chest and told him if he ever did that to me again, again. I wouldn't be so nice about it next time. I walked away. All I could think about was getting to a bathroom as fast as possible to rinse the taste of him out of my mouth. I felt disgusted and violated. Now, Al Franken has released two statements in response to these allegations. The first statement was very brief. He wrote, "I certainly don't remember the rehearsal for the skit in the same way, but I send my sincerest apologies to Leanne. As to the photo, it was clearly intended to be funny, but wasn't. I shouldn't have done it." So that gets to the second part of the allegation, and this is where she has pretty damning evidence. Let's go to graphic number three, please. She shared this photo of the tour that she was speaking of. She had fallen asleep because she had just returned from a tour in Afghanistan. She was a member of the military. She is a veteran. And while she was asleep, Franken posed in this way for the photo. And it's degrading. It's disgusting. And Franken later released a longer statement addressing that component of the allegations. So let me go ahead and read that to you right now. He says, "I don't know what was in my head when I took that picture, and it doesn't matter. There's no excuse. I look at it now and I feel disgusted with myself. It isn't funny. It's completely inappropriate. It's obvious how Leanne would feel violated by that picture. And what's more, I can see how millions of other women would feel violated by it. Women who have had similar experiences in their own lives. Women who fear having those experiences. Women who look up to me. Women who have counted on me. And the truth is, what people think of me in light of this is far less important than what people think of women who continue to come forward to tell their stories. They deserve to be heard and believed, and they deserve to know that I am their ally and supporter. I have let them down, and I am committed to making it up to them." So we have some video of Leanne Tweeden speaking to Jake Tapper. We'll get to that in just a minute, but I kind of want to open it up to you guys and hear your thoughts.
We were talking about this earlier today, and
so we've covered it.
It's a problem because there is a spectrum. It seems there's there are different gradations of sexual misconduct. So the apology, as it reads, you really don't know how bad the sexual misconduct was, right? It was a pretty powerful apology, and I, as a man, feel sort of awkward even commenting or judging the gradations. I can certainly say this is different than stalking a 14-year-old at a mall and then calling her at a high school and trying to ask her out on a date when you're in your 30s. I mean, I can definitely separate these two things. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is this is wrong, but with all of these allegations coming forward, I'm having trouble ordering them all and assigning a priority to how bad each one is. I'm not excusing this at all. I'm simply trying to order it because they're all getting jumbled together.
I get what you mean. And look, I think most rational people know that there's a difference between, you know, outright sexual assault or pedophilia. And, you know, what happened to Leanne Tweeden is horrible. And she felt violated and degraded. And I think most women would feel like that. No one has any right to put their hands on anyone else without consent. And taking that degrading picture was, you know, beyond offensive and degrading. However, look, I think that all women are different. All women respond to different, you know, different types of assault or different types of harassment in various ways. And so what might be considered not a big deal if it's an ass grab to one woman might end up, you know, really making another woman feel incredibly unsafe or, you know, degraded, whatever it is. And so I hate getting into these discussions about what's worse, but I think what's more important to focus on is this broader discussion about this sense of entitlement that all of these perpetrators have had, right? Like, I think that's like the one constant among all of them.
The power thing
and the abuse of power and this sense of entitlement, this sense of, yeah, I'm going to do this and I'm not worried about any consequences.
Yeah.
And think about this. This happened in 2006. There never were any consequences. He went on to be a senator. He went on to live his life. And this was something that she quietly lived with behind the scenes for all this time. And it's because she felt that she couldn't come forward because people were going to attack her. And by the way, that has happened. And she talks about that with Jake Tapper. Now, I want to go to her videos. Video number two, she talks about why in a lot of cases, women don't come forward. Decades will go by and they will just remain quiet. Take a look.
I was nervous to come out about it. This doesn't make me feel good. Everybody goes, oh, you're so strong. You're going to feel so great talking about it. I still have a knot in my stomach. This is, you know, this isn't some like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do it and I feel great about it.
It's difficult. It's difficult to do.
It is hard. Why do you think there are people that haven't talked? There's still a lot of people that haven't told their stories. And there, you know, in the case of Roy Moore, there are people that 40 years later that are reluctantly coming out about it. I mean, it's embarrassing. It's humiliating. There are still people I've looked on Twitter that are still blaming me for it. I'm like, you look at the picture, I'm asleep, and they're still, somehow it's my fault.
Right.
Really? Okay. Al Franken has come out and apologized and said, you know what? That was in poor taste. I thought it was funny, and it's still my fault.
Well, that's okay. Why
women don't come out.
Well, I mean, first of all, the biggest mistake she's made, the only mistake she's made, is going on Twitter. She should not go on Twitter because she's only going to get that kind of criticism. I think, you know, the attention grabbing thing here is the photograph, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's got, to me, that obfuscates the real. The disgusting thing that Franken did, which was push himself on. You have to remember, too, Al Franken in 2006 was months before he even announced his candidacy for Senate. He'd been in a writer's room at Saturday Night Live, and we've all read books or at least articles about what that life was like for a very long time. He was a goofball, and I didn't think he was that funny ever until he wrote a book, which was funny. So the photograph of him going like this, as stupid as that is and as offensive as that is, that's probably the goofball comedian thing that he's prone to doing. And I think it really takes the story in a different direction, because it's not just that. It's that he forced himself upon a woman in that situation when it didn't have to happen. And if that's true, and listen, the other thing that happens with these stories, and I don't know anything about Franken, but every single time this happens, there are other accusers who follow. There are other stories, other anecdotes. It hasn't happened yet with Franken, and it may tomorrow, it may tonight, it may with somebody else, and we forget about Franken because this is happening in such rapid fire. But I think that what people have to, you know, keep hold of with this Franken thing is what is he violated this woman, and not in that stupid photograph, which was stupid to take, and he did violate her, but I mean, I just think the context of Al Franken, a comedian, is very different than Al Franken, a man in a position of power who was a comedian with a younger performer violating her womanhood, violating everything about her. So I just think that the picture, to me, serves as a distraction to what the real offense was.
Yeah, I have a different take on the picture.
Yeah, which you're probably right about, because I think I might be in a minority about this. But I just think the context of a comedian who I never found funny doing something that was really not funny is that.
And that's a little bit of the, you know, explanation that he got at in his longer statement.
Did he talk about it? Yeah, he did.
So I want to be clear. When I read the longer statement, that wasn't the full statement. You should read the full statement for yourself. But he does get into how, you know, at the time he thought this was funny. It was like a comedy thing. But look, think about, I don't care if you're a comedian, because think about what this really communicates to a woman like Leanne Tweeden, or women in general. She had literally gotten back from a tour in Afghanistan. She's wearing her military gear, okay? And he poses in a picture where he's degrading her by pretending like he's grabbing her breasts while she's asleep. By the way, she didn't know the picture was being taken. She didn't even find out about it until much later.
It's
right?
Inexcusable.
It is inexcusable.
It's inexcusable. And I just mean that I don't want it to distract from what he actually did.
No, that I agree with you on, because, you know, the physical assault is a serious accusation. And since there's proof in the form of a photo of the second part of the allegation.
It makes the first part more believable.
And that's what Michael's saying, that that's essentially stealing the spotlight on this story. And we can rank the two things. I mean, the sexual assault or the physical assault, better put, that I think ranks worse. It's sophomoric. It's like a frat house thing.
Right.
She's asleep and you're going, he's, you know, leaning into the picture. It was clearly done in that comic spirit for him, but it didn't pass the litmus test of comedy as we've seen.
Which, by the way, none of his stuff really did. When he was on Saturday Night Live, you remember, I didn't think he was that funny.
So, no,
this was exactly like in line with his humor.
I disagree. I think Al Franken. I think, and here's why it matters to us, because he was a voice of he was a clear voice on Capitol Hill as he segued into the Democratic Party.
For sure.
And so it hurts and kind of smarts on that level as well. But whether it was funny or not, that wasn't funny, and it doesn't stand the test of time.
Yes, it does not stand the test of time. Finally, I just want to go to another video of Leanne Tweeden speaking to Jake Tapper. She was asked if she accepts his apology, and I thought her answer was interesting. Take a look.
Do you accept his apology?
I do. And you know, the one that came out this morning, I accepted that one too. It was very short and very brief. My initial reaction was it sounded like a staffer put that out hastily. You know, which maybe could have been the truth, you know, to get it out quickly, because when it hit, it was, you know, it went viral and it was everywhere. But that one did seem heartfelt, and I believe it, and I believe him, you know, and I honestly do believe him. And, you know, I wasn't waiting for an apology from him, but I gladly accept it. And thank you, Senator Franken.
Do you want him to call you?
Sure.
That last question. I know what he meant by that last question.
It sounded
so weird.
It sounded really weird.
It sounded
so
weird.
So, would you like a second date?
Yeah. Right, would you like him to call you? Anyway.
And the whole dynamic is fascinating, because we haven't seen the accuser asked that. These accusers asked about this, and you know, and going back to the photo, also, the more evidence you have of something like this, the more believable the crux of the story is. So
absolutely.
If you have that goofy thing that he thought he was being goofy about, that photo, even if it isn't the offense, it makes the offense certainly seem more credible.
Absolutely.
You know? And I think that's an important.
Although, again, I see the two so differently. I don't know that really is true. I see one as a wah wah and it really being a stupid idea, but in that category. And then the other is a guy trying to take a shot or something, like a really.
No, I know, but I mean is that you see that there's this sort of this line of thinking in this man's head at that time that could lead you to believe that he would have done that.
Yeah.
He sexualizes this woman.
So one other thing that I want to get to before we go to break, because this is also an important component to the story. Al Franken took responsibility and apologized immediately. And that's what he should do. And I'm glad that he apologized. But you don't see the same type of behavior from someone like Roy Moore, who remains defiant. He has now been accused by several women who said that, you know, they were preyed upon when they were teenagers. He was banned from a mall. He was banned from a YMCA because he was known to go to those places looking for teen girls that he could prey on. And I mean, there are people in Alabama who knew him and knew about this open secret, talking to the media. These are not liberals. These are not progressives. These are Trump supporting Alabamans that, did I say that right? Alabamans?
Yeah. Alabamians.
Alabamians, yes.
I would have accepted the way she said it.
Well, you probably can accept, but they say Alabamian. Or
anyway.
Okay.
Anyway.
But,
doesn't matter.
So they're coming
Trump
forward.
Supporting.
And they're talking about, you know, what they experienced. And Roy Moore, here's what he tweeted about the Franken story today that I thought was amazing. Al Franken admits guilt after photographic evidence of his abuse surfaces. Mitch, meaning Mitch McConnell, let's investigate. Which, by the way, to Mitch McConnell's credit, he did want to do an ethics investigation into Al Franken. And then he says, in Alabama, zero evidence, allegations 100% rejected. By the way, 100% rejected by whom? By you. You're the only person who rejects them.
Right.
And then Mitch McConnell, again, to his credit, says that Moore must quit immediately or be expelled. So he's complaining that Mitch McConnell is treating him similarly to how he's treating Al Franken.
Well, yeah. Can I have that for a second?
Sure.
Okay, first of all, Al Franken is a U.S. senator. There is a process by which you go through. Roy Moore is not.
Mm-hmm.
So for him to say that Roy Moore should not be a candidate, should not stand, should drop out, should be expelled, all of those things, he has a right to say. He's a citizen. Al Franken has to go through this process if the process is to begin. It's one that Franken wants to go through, that Chuck Schumer said he should go through. I'm going to challenge you on one of the things you said. To his credit, he said, let's investigate.
Mm-hmm.
In moments after Al Franken had this allegation, Mitch McConnell said, let's investigate.
Mm-hmm.
when we knew about 15 women who accused candidate Donald Trump of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, when we saw a tape where he said, grab him by the pussy, Mitch McConnell said nothing.
I will totally concede, and I agree with you 100%.
And Mitch McConnell allowed his wife to serve in the cabinet of this man. So I think there's a spinelessness about Mitch McConnell in this case that is inexcusable. That said, the Roy Moore remark about 100% unbelievable, that 100% refuted, because people seem to be glomming onto this stuff in a
right.
big way.
And more and more accusations came out today. So they will continue, and we'll see what happens with Roy Moore. But he remains defiant, refuses to pull out of the Senate race in Alabama.
It looks greater and greater like Doug Jones will be the senator from Alabama. The polling has been high. As a matter of fact, there was a poll today, which I actually don't believe, that showed that Barack Obama is more popular in Alabama than Roy Moore is, which is astonishing to me.
It's astonishing that it would be astonishing. Yeah.
Right, well, that's true. That's a good point. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Pedophilia or Barack Obama.
Right.
21 seconds I want. It's important for the Democratic Party here. Mm-hmm. All these senators have come out and criticized Al Franken. The Democrats have to take the right stand on this issue. And if it's true and these things happened, there should be no patience for Al Franken in this case because of the brand. And I said this to Mark earlier, I think this guarantees, and the series of allegations should guarantee that a woman is on the ticket in 2020, either at the top or the bottom of the ticket, because I think the Democrats can own this issue and can get women voters to understand. And I'm not apologizing that it's politics, because he's a senator and this is politics. And we're talking about elections. They should own this and show women that they are the party that's standing up to it, while you see these Republicans coddling this pedophile in Alabama, this accused pedophile in Alabama. So I think it's an opportunity, too, and they can sacrifice Al Franken's Senate seat. He's a good senator with good voting record and all of that, but he can easily be replaced by another Democrat. And I pointed this out earlier, too, is that Keith Ellison is a congressman from Minnesota, a possibility for their governor, Mark Dayton, a former senator, to appoint to the Senate seat should Al Franken resign, which we're not even close to having happen. And then if Roy Moore wins and Keith Ellison is the senator, Roy Moore is serving with a Muslim. So there's that.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. The controversy known as Russiagate has dominated media attention over the past year. And now it's directly impacting the media itself. The Russian parliament has just voted to require all mass media outlets in Russia that receive overseas funding to register as a foreign agent. The move is a retaliation to the Justice Department, which has just forced the Russian state finance network RT America to register also as a foreign agent. RT complied on Monday to avoid the risk of having its assets seized by the U.S. government or even its executives put under arrest. While a few civil liberties advocates have voiced concerns about RT being forced to register as a foreign agent, many have been completely silent, as have many of RT's colleagues in the media. I'm joined now by Max Blumenthal, senior editor for Alternet's Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Welcome, Max. Your thoughts on this decision by the Justice Department to force RT America to register as a foreign agent?
Well, this is the attack on press freedom that the liberal resistance and mainstream journalists had been warning of ever since Trump came into power. The ironic thing is that they goaded the Trump Justice Department into doing this. This foreign agent listing is actually the product of a years-long campaign, beginning really in earnest in 2014, that was initiated by a small cadre of neoconservative operatives, Peter Pomerantsev, Michael Weiss, Jamie Kirchick, and Ann Applebaum, who's a columnist for The Washington Post. And they've worked through organizations like the Atlantic Council, which is funded by NATO, as well as the Saudi, Turkish, Bahraini, and Qatari governments. kind of sounds like a foreign agent there. in order to pressure the U.S. government into doing this. They succeeded amidst this McCarthyite atmosphere where, you know, you have Democratic lawmakers howling about Russia attacking the U.S. and the attack being worse than Pearl Harbor, Hillary Clinton claiming it's worse than 9/11, likening it to 9/11. And so this was sort of another aspect of the unprecedented sanctions that have been imposed on Russia under the watch of the Trump administration. The Russian consulate in San Francisco was actually raided by FBI agents. So RT is the next victim. The government has done absolutely nothing to demonstrate how RT American programs or the journalists who work for RT are taking direct orders from the Kremlin, which is what's required under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. They have to demonstrate that they have lobbied Congress on behalf of a foreign government or are disseminating information materials on behalf of that government at the orders of that government. None of this has been demonstrated. It seems to be an arbitrary demand. The mainstream reports on RT America have kind of framed it as RT sort of agreeing to register as a foreign agent. But RT America did not agree. It was threatened with the arrest of its news director, Misha Solodovnikov, and the freezing of its assets. You know, these are, I wouldn't call them Gestapo tactics, but they are definitely anti-democratic. The U.S. government has also done nothing to demonstrate how RT is different from Al Jazeera, which is funded by the Qatari government and, you know, definitely promotes the Qatari line on foreign policy in many cases. The BBC does the same. France 24, I-24 out of Israel, CCTV, the Chinese broadcaster. How are these broadcasters any different?
Max, so
we can't really establish that.
Right. Max, so you mentioned that the Justice Department has not provided any evidence to substantiate its designation of RT America as a foreign agent. So the most detailed thing we have so far from the government, and actually what the investigation followed from, was the DNI report last January on alleged Russian meddling in the U.S. election. And RT America was a big part of that. And that report offers extensive documentation of the U.S. government's thoughts about RT and what it feels threatened by. And I want to quote from it. It says, the network highlights criticism of alleged U.S. shortcomings in democracy and civil liberties. It also goes on to point out that RT covered things like Occupy Wall Street and the anti-fracking movement. All this is seen as part of the nefarious Russian effort to meddle in the U.S. And of course, it doesn't mention the fact that RT has about less than 30,000 viewers in the U.S. apparently, and is not even inside the Nielsen cable rankings of the top 94 networks. But I'm wondering if you think that the content of RT America, a lot of it, which is critical of U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy, factored into this decision.
Well, of course. I mean, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in its January report this year, which came about basically because the Trump administration was saying, prove there's collusion, prove all your allegations. And so they dumped this report. 8 out of the 23 pages of the report related to RT America's content. And as you said, the report finds RT guilty of, quote, unquote, promoting radical discontent, covering Occupy and fracking, hosting a third-party debate, covering the Syrian civil war from an angle that is alternately opposed to the American and Western regime change campaign. These kinds of things relate to content that should be completely permissible in any open society. It definitely filled a void in the U.S. And, you know, there's been very little that the government has been able to produce to demonstrate that some operatives in the Kremlin are giving instructions to RT employees to, pump out certain elements of propaganda. While you could argue that, you know, RT might be an arm of soft power of the Russian government, I don't see how that makes it any different from any of the other foreign state broadcasters that are working in Washington. And beyond that, you know, I go on at RT fairly regularly. I mean, you could say occasionally, to talk about my work and to talk about the, you know, the issues that I cover that are completely forbidden and frozen out by the three main cable news networks and by much of the U.S. mainstream media and even progressive media. You know, The Real News is one of the only other networks that lets me do that. So that's another reason why RT is being sanctioned in, by the U.S. government or slapped with this foreign agent label is, you know, it's to suppress the narrative that the U.S. and that the West are extremely uncomfortable with. Alex Salmond, who was the former leader of the Scottish National Party, has just taken a show with RT UK. And you can just turn to the UK and see the British establishment media just absolutely in a complete meltdown about the fact that Salmond has taken a show with RT. And it's because he couldn't have gotten a platform anywhere else. And they are upset that this very tightly controlled conformist narrative that they had been enforcing as, you know, establishment gatekeepers is being broken. So they're calling on the government to register RT and to try to drive it out of the broadcasting environment. Jamie Kirchick, the neoconservative operative I mentioned before, who is, you know, a advocate of permanent war, who has called for Chelsea Manning to be executed. He argued in a Washington Post editorial and in his presentation at the Atlanta Council that RT should be registered as a foreign agent as a means of intimidating its American employees into quitting and deterring other American media professionals from taking jobs with the network. So it's clearly...
Max, let's play that clip. I have that clip of Jamie Kirchick. He's speaking recently at the Atlantic at an Atlantic Council event where he calls for a private sector initiative to basically encourage media outlets to tell any prospective candidate that we're not going to hire you if you work at RT. This is what he said.
This should be maybe some sort of informal agreement by reputable news outlets. So they're, so the young up-and-coming 22 and 23-year-old journalists in the West who, you know, maybe not didn't get the job that they wanted at the BBC and are tempted to take that offer from RT, which will give them a lot of airtime. Maybe they won't take that job offer if they know that they will never get a job afterwards at any reputable news organization. So I think these are some of the private sector initiatives that need to be undertaken, you know, to name and shame and isolate RT and push it out of the respectable precincts of society.
So that's Jamie Kirchick, Max, speaking recently to the Atlantic Council. I also saw just this weekend on Twitter, there was a comedian who used to work for The Daily Show, called on anybody who works for the RT comedy show, Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp. She called on them to quit their jobs, and she said, get work elsewhere so as not to be useful idiots. So there's a culture right now of hostility towards RT, pushed by people on both the right and the left.
Yeah, I mean, for like a failing American regime jester like Jenna Friedman, who was responsible for that McCarthyite statement, bashing RT is maybe a convenient way of getting attention and seeming like you actually care about something without offending any of the powers that be. You know, she encouraged RT employees and specifically the staff of Redacted Tonight, which is an extremely successful show fronted by the comedian Lee Camp at RT America, which has demonstrated total editorial independence and is really popular on the left. She urged them to quit and take up jobs with Teen Vogue. Teen Vogue this month is guest edited by Hillary Clinton, so I'm sure that would work out just great. You know, this is the level of delusional thinking that prevails within the ranks of the idiot liberals that I call idlibs.
Max, you mentioned earlier that, you know, we've been hearing warnings all year about Trump's crackdown on the media. And I want to read you a few headlines. CNN's Brian Stelter, Trump's reaching for ways to punish the media for stories he doesn't like. The Guardian, Trump has declared war. Journalists denounce any attack on press freedom. Democracy Now, a Trump presidency could end press freedom. The New York Times, Trump calling journalists sick people puts media on edge. None of these outlets have criticized this move against RT. Some have even not even mentioned it. So I'm wondering your response, on the media's non-response to this RT news.
Well, I mean, the Washington Post changed its slogan for the Trump era to "Democracy Dies in Darkness," and the Washington Post proceeded to initiate and amplify the campaign against RT America on the grounds that it was part and parcel of a Kremlin attack on America's otherwise shining democracy. And, you know, we see with the Washington Post silence that, you know, democracy is dying and they're bringing the darkness. That's, you know, pretty much been the case for all of the, you know, mainstream pundits, corporate media, you know, talking heads and journalists, and even Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman, who has, you know, sort of in a soft way pushed the Russiagate narrative. But the rest of these figures have really hyped it up. Brian Stelter, who's the media critic for CNN, has positioned himself as a defender of press freedom, but he has actually attempted to kind of humiliate guests like Larry Johnson, who is a former CIA operative and is now kind of a blogger, writer, for merely appearing on RT. Jake Tapper stood up in the White House press gallery during the Obama era and confronted White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs for calling Fox News not a real news organization when Fox News was, you know, claiming that Barack Obama was a secret Muslim. And Jake Tapper has also encouraged this campaign against RT. He's even directly personally attacked RT America employees on social media. So the hypocrisy is so obvious here. And I think a lot of these figures are a little bit ashamed of what they've accomplished because they've created a precedent for the government to drive out not only foreign state media, but to suppress other dissident voices while they go around trying to champion themselves as defenders of press freedom.
We'll leave it there. Max Blumenthal, senior editor for Alternet's Gray Zone Project, where his two-part series on the figures behind the Russiagate frenzy is up right now, and we'll link to it. Max is also the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
The Federal Communications Commission has approved the most sweeping changes in a generation when it comes to the ownership of local newspapers, TV, and radio stations. Hari Srinivasan has the story from our New York studios.
The FCC voted today to do away with a long-standing set of rules that prevented an individual or company from owning TV stations and newspapers in the same market. The change allows a person or company to own both a newspaper and a TV station or radio station in the same local market. It also means broadcasters could own two of the top four stations in a given market. It all comes as the media and digital landscape is in the midst of a dramatic transformation. But there are concerns about the new impact. Keech Hagee is a media reporter with The Wall Street Journal. So when we talk about local markets, how much of an impact do these rules have on, say, the news ecosystem in a local market?
A huge impact. I mean, this is what keeps broadcast TV owners from being able to own two of the top TV stations in a market, which they've been straining against these rules for years. And looking at how the ecosystem has evolved, the broadcast newspaper ownership ban had a huge impact on how what the world looks like today. Unfortunately, the repeal of this is just a little too late for the newspapers.
Right, because TV stations aren't interested in buying newspapers. They're not as profitable as they once were.
Right.
But they could buy each other, or right. A larger conglomerate could buy multiple stations in that market.
Totally. But for many decades, you know, a lot of companies were bumping up against these rules and shaping themselves accordingly.
And so what's the FCC's rationale and all the supporters behind this?
The rationale is that, look around, this is not a world of three major broadcast networks and like one or two newspapers in a town anymore. There's Facebook, there's Google, people are increasingly getting their news online and from zillions of different sources. And this notion that people need to be, you know, protected from the possible monopoly power of a local broadcaster is, you know, it's a little silly.
So this isn't the specific case about Sinclair Broadcast, but that's been kind of part of this conversation, at least in the background.
Right.
How are they impacted by this?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. They certainly will be helped a little bit, especially in this pending deal they have to buy Tribune Media. These rules that were rolled back today really affect the larger markets. And Sinclair traditionally is in smaller markets, is sort of the biggest player in smaller markets. But if it buys Tribune, it will be in bigger markets. And so it won't have to spin off as many stations if it does get this merger done. But bigger picture, a lot of why you're hearing so much about Sinclair is there have been other regulatory changes. There is one of the rules that was rolled back today about JSAs, joint service agreements. It's complicated, but it basically lets broadcast station owners operate another station in their market. That Sinclair's been doing that for years. That will be very beneficial to Sinclair, and generally the regulatory environment has been very beneficial to them in the last year.
But what are the concerns about media consolidation that these rules raise?
Well, the people who oppose this change are worried that having fewer voices in a community is going to be bad for democracy. It's going to be bad for debate. And especially that allowing these TV companies especially to consolidate their newsrooms is going to mean journalists are going to be laid off. You know, companies are going to look for cost efficiencies, and there's going to be less news. Of course, the companies say, no, this is going to make it easier for us to make our newsrooms profitable. So we'll see.
Have there been companies kind of waiting on the sidelines for a relaxation of these kind of rules, ready to sort of go on a buying spree?
Absolutely. I mean, the broadcast industry has been straining against these rules for years, lobbying against them for years. So I think what we'll see most of is some like swaps between two big station groups, might like trade stations back and forth so that one can have two stations in one market and the other one can have two stations in the other market, because the real advantage is market power within a specific city.
All right, Keech Hagee of the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
We begin today with news from the president of Lebanon, who says Saudi Arabia is detaining his prime minister and that the situation is being viewed as an act of aggression. Prime Minister Saeed Hariri abruptly resigned from his position on November 4th while in Riyadh, and many believe he was pressured into the decision by the Saudis. Let's go live now to RT correspondent Alex Mihaljevic, who is in Toronto. Alex, what are we hearing from the president of Lebanon regarding this situation?
Well, get ready for a lot of twists and turns. Let's start with a president who's saying that Hariri and his family are being held by the Saudis in Riyadh. Well, Mr. Hariri himself came out on Twitter and gave a bit of a different story. He's saying that he's perfectly fine and he's going to come back to dear old Lebanon as he promised. The prime minister, I should say the president, said there nothing justifies Hariri's lack of return for the 12 days, and therefore he considers him detained. We're hearing something a little bit different from Hariri in that tweet as well. Hariri's promise to come back to Beirut. Also, there's a little twist there now. We're hearing that President Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has invited Hariri and his family to France, and that Hariri has taken him up on that offer, meaning that he'd go straight from Riyadh to Paris within the next few days instead of going back to Lebanon. Lots of twists and turns, as I mentioned. And now we're also hearing from Hariri's brother, Baha. He is saying another story, twisting this into a different direction. He's blasting Iran and the militant group Hezbollah, who's a part of the government there in Lebanon. He's also saying that he's thanking Saudi Arabia for decades of support in Lebanon. So a lot of people have been saying this, that Hariri is actually aligned with Saudi Arabia. He was actually born there, and that this is all a ploy to destabilize Lebanon. His resignation on November the 4th was meant to do exactly that. And now we're hearing from his brother, and we're also hearing from Lebanese media that his brother is looking at maybe the prime minister's seat, since his brother, obviously, Hariri, has quit the job, citing that he was afraid for his life, that there actually might be assassination attempts on him. We know that his father was assassinated, and you'd think as president of or prime minister of Lebanon, you'd know that there'd be some danger involved there.
Alex, like you say, many have said that Saudi Arabia has been actively trying to destabilize Lebanon, and this is just the latest attempt to do so. So what can you tell us about that?
I mean, just look at the story. Just look how many twists and turns there are so far in it. And so we know that Saudi Arabia for ages has been looking at Lebanon as an area of interest. Just by taking a look at this map here, look, Saudi Arabia is huge. Iran is huge. They both have interest in that little country that is nestled there between Syria and Israel. There's been a proxy war of kinds going on there for decades. And just the situation on the ground, obviously, is getting worse and worse when we're seeing that this type of posturing is happening and that there's actually Lebanese politicians involved. Now, the Saudi Arabians have come out and said that the militant group Hezbollah, which is a Shiite group, that Hezbollah wants to destroy the Arab world. And Hezbollah is saying, well, you know what? We're just looking at another situation where the Saudis are mixing in Lebanese politics and they want to destabilize the country. Now, we know both Iran and Saudi Arabia have interest in Lebanon, but Saudi Arabia is playing a very dirty game here, especially with the prime minister and the maneuvering that it's doing currently. Some are even saying that Israel is involved in this whole equation. We know that this very strange bedfellows here, Saudi Arabia and Israel, when it comes to Lebanon, they both have their interests in that part of the world. And Saudi Arabia, as usual, we've seen some dirty games being played, proxy wars in Saudi Arabia, the war in Yemen, and even Iraq. Their fingers have been in all of that, including the birth and the growth of ISIS. So this, for Saudi Arabia, is nothing beyond our imagination, let's say. This is just another move to try to realign things in the Middle East to their advantage.
Alex, thank you so much for staying on top of this. That's RT America correspondent Alex Mihaljevic in Toronto.
Get 'em in, get 'em in. That sun is hot and plenty bright. Let's get on to business and get home tonight. Bid 'em in. Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy. She's good for a start. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Now here's a real goodbye on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homie queen. Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Bid 'em in. Gonna start at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents, take a good look-see. Cause I know you'll want her once you've seen her. She's young and ripe, make a darn good breeder. Bid 'em in. She's good in the field, she can sew and cook. Strip her down, Roy, let the gentleman look. She's full up front and ample behind. Examine her teeth if you got a mind. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Here's a bid of 3 from a man who's thrifty. 325, can I hear 350? Your money ain't earning you much in the banks. Turn around, Roy, let him look at her flanks. Bid 'em in. 350's bidding, I'm looking for 4. At $400, she's a bargain, sure. 4 is the bid, 450. 5, $500, now look alive. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Don't mind them tears, that's one of her tricks. 550's bidding, who'll say 6? She's healthy and strong and well-equipped. Make a fine lady's maid when she's properly whipped. Bid 'em in. 6, 650, don't be slow. 7 is the bid, gonna let her go. At 7, she's going, going, gone. Pull her down, Roy, bring the next one on. Bid 'em in, get 'em in, bid 'em in.
And this is Community Progressive Radio. My name is Bernard White, and the name of this program is Wake Up Call. Now we turn our attention to the issue of reparations. Once Barack Obama was elected, the discussion about reparations began to increase, not only here in the United States, but throughout the Caribbean. In fact, some people thought that since Barack Obama was elected president, that was reparations. During this period, I wound up going to a couple of the meetings where presentations around reparations were made, and I thought that I knew a lot about reparations, only to find out that I didn't know as much as I thought I did. I know that European countries, those involved in slavery, benefited immensely from the slavery business, but I got a better idea of how slavery continues to affect the African population. In a few moments, we're going to hear from Sir Hilary MacDonald Beckles, who is a native-born Barbadian historian. He is the current Vice Chancellor of the University of the West Indies, and one of his important positions, he is the chair of CARICOM's Reparations Commission. And we're going to hear from Dr. Beckles, who has a very interesting story to tell.
Our most honorable Prime Minister, Dr. Ralf Gonzalez, my former colleague and mentor and friend, advisor and counselor. And Mrs. Gonzalez, our distinguished leader of the opposition, excellencies, distinguished members of parliament, members of the clergy, the judiciary, and the civil society, my colleagues, students, members of the Reparations Committee, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. For me, it is always a great pleasure to be here in St. Vincent and the Grenadines. There is a rumor of sorts in my family that I was conceived in St. Vincent. I do not know if the Constitution makes provision for citizenship on the basis of conception. But occasionally, when there is a little dispute between my parents, I hear rumors about my father being in St. Vincent and my mother coming to visit. And those are the rumors that abound in my household. But of course, we all know as a Barbadian, if there is one society in the Caribbean that has a very special social, emotional, and intimate affinity with this island, Barbados. I had the great pleasure in 2001 at the UN conference in Durban to be asked by the Prime Minister to represent this nation in those deliberations. It was an enormous honor, and I had the pleasure of returning to St. Vincent and the Grenadines to brief the cabinet on the outcomes of those deliberations. And I have taken these matters of representation and of responsibility very, very seriously indeed. In a sense, then, this presentation is the second part, or maybe the public part, of a presentation that was made to the cabinet in 2001. And time has evolved. I can now share with you how the issues around this subject have developed. It has always been understood by some of our finest thinkers, that as we entered into this second phase of nation building, that as we enter into this second phase of building Caribbean nations, that there would be some conversations, some discussions that will emerge within the context of this second phase that might not have been appropriate or ready for the first phase. The reparatory discourse is one such conversation. Despite the fact that many groups in our society have spoken about this matter over the last 50 years, and we have to give respect, of course, to the Rastafarian community for raising those questions and for championing these issues at a time when society on the whole was not prepared already to even understand those conversations. But we are now into phase two. And as we go into phase three, maybe 40, 50 years from now, there will be other conversations that will emerge that might not have been appropriate for the first and the second phase. We are now into 40, 50 years of national independence in this region. And we are now ready to have certain conversations. Maybe we had to wait for community consciousness to evolve, to be prepared to have those conversations. Maybe we had to wait for a new generation of political leaders who are prepared to have those conversations. And it's appropriate that we are having this conversation here in St. Vincent, because not only was this island a critical and important historical site in the 17th and 18th century of resistance, of the protection of the indigenous nationhood of our people. And we have now returned to this site 100 years later. But it's also appropriate that we have in Prime Minister Gonzalez a leader of the second phase who is willing to take these conversations forward. So in that sense, everything in its season, everything in its time, and the time is now. Jamaica has just celebrated 50 years of its independence. Jamaica is now prepared. Barbados will be entering into its 50th year in 3 years' time. It is now ready. These societies were not ready 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so we're having this conversation about reparatory justice. Now, I'm going to begin with the first slide, and I'm going to give you a series of images, because these are images that tell the story. They tell all the things that we need to say about this subject. A few years ago, the British government adjusted their provisions for the public ventilation of official documents. Official secret documents. The year, the time of closure was removed from 50 to 30 years in some instances. And some documents became available to us now that we were not able to have 30 years ago. And in those British archives, this is one of the photographs that I stumbled upon. And it's a photograph that tells us all that we need to know about this subject. It's a good frame for the conversation. And I have used this photograph on the cover of the book. This photograph is taken in 1966, in the year that Barbados became an independent nation. And a young Queen Elizabeth II is visiting Barbados. And as you can see, the Queen and Prince Philip there. And so far, so good. Nothing unusual. The Queen can visit her colonies. But she is accompanied by her first cousin, the 7th Earl of Harewood, who is the owner of this plantation. This is his plantation, the Bell Plantation in Barbados. And this plantation had been in his family since 1782. So from 1782, this plantation, which was bought by his ancestors, has been in his family, and he has inherited this plantation from his ancestor, who was the first Earl of Harewood. This is now the 7th Earl of Harewood, and this estate has passed from the first Earl, the second Earl, the third Earl, down to this gentleman, the 7th Earl. And he has invited his cousin, the Queen, to his plantation for a banquet. When this plantation was bought by the first Earl, 380 acres of land, 232 enslaved Africans were on it. And all of that property and wealth have passed down, and here we have crystallized an interesting photograph of our Queen visiting her cousin on his plantation, on which they have enslaved hundreds and hundreds of peoples in the Caribbean. But we will go further, and I will go in a circle, and I will tell you a story, and I will come back to this in the end, because we have to see how the story of the exploitation of our people took place at all levels of British society. And I'm going to take you from the top of the society to the bottom of the society and back again. We go to the next image.